everyone. Can you all hear? So in the next 15 minutes, I'm going to be talking to you a little bit about the findings of an ethnographic research project that examined the sexual relationships and healthcare engagement among 31 black MSM in New York City. I'm going to be focusing on a subset of the findings from this larger study, and I'm going to be interested mostly in the spatial and social configuration of these relationships, so kind of looking at the physical and virtual spaces in which sexual relationships and sexual behaviors happened. And this will be quite a descriptive presentation. I'm going to try and draw as much as possible on the ethnographic material. You'll notice in the title I'm going to be talking a lot about social risks, so just quickly I'll give you a 101 on what I mean. So in medical anthropology or the anthropology of public health, so we sometimes talk about social risk to understand why people might do behaviors which are unhealthy. But more broadly here, when I talk about social risk and in the context of sexual behavior, I'm talking about important dimensions of the subjective experience of finding sexual partners and negotiating sexual relationships. And I'm really interested in how these kind of relationships and interactions are embedded in particular social contexts and relate to kind of broader social and economic factors. So the social risks are things that people worry about or things that people have to take into consideration in their interactions with sexual partners. So this includes things like not using condoms in order to demonstrate love or trust to one's partner. It also includes engaging in sex work to earn extra money. And the main point is that the kind of juggling of multiple different kinds of concerns in particular contexts means that in relationships or in sexual interactions, what is considered risky and what is considered as an acceptable or unavoidable form of risk is embedded in particular contexts and life circumstances. I know in public health that HIV risk is something we think about all the time. And a point that I want to emphasize here is that in people's lives, people navigate different kinds of risks and face different kinds of opportunities and constraints. And these various forms of risk are often considered to be more important or more obviously and immediately consequential than the health risk of HIV infection. So I'm going to just talk a bit about the study. 31 black MSM were recruited through the internet, through nightclubs, bars, and community health centers. They were eligible if they were 15 years or older, if they were born as and identified as male, and if they had had anal or oral sex with a man in the last 12 months. We also had two community advisory boards, a client-led cab and a provider cab, and they really helped us identify 17 key informants. So these are people who were working with black MSM in New York City who had a lot of experience with this population. Interviews with the 31 men were, there were three per man, there were 90 minutes each, and all of them were coded using, we developed a code book based kind of on the theoretical ideas you went in with, and then we jigged them around, adjusted them depending on what emerged from the data. They were coded using Atlas TI and analyzed. There was also a participant observation dimension to this, so the lead ethnographer, who's not here today, Jonathan Garcia, He was the lead ethnographer, and he conducted participant observation, or maybe outside of anthropology, we call it deep hanging out. And that was in places where the guys hung out, so including like home places, house parties, bars and clubs, NGOs, and virtual spaces. I'm just going to tell you a little bit about the sample. So most of the men in the sample were of low socioeconomic status. About a third had been incarcerated, a third had experienced housing instability in the last 12 months. Under half were employed, five had experienced homelessness in the last 12 months. In terms of health, so 23 self-reported as HIV negative and 8 self-reported as HIV positive. 17 had public insurance and 9 of them were uninsured. And in terms of sexual identity, just under half identified as gay, 3 identified as same gender loving, 4 as bisexual, 3 as straight, and 4 identified as discreet. Coming to the kind of spaces that people talked about, men sought sexual partners in a variety of spaces, including commercial venues such as gay bars and nightclubs, also gyms and restaurants, and then public spaces. So meeting people in the street, meeting people in parks and on trains. Most men had used technologies such as apps and websites at some point, and many of them use them regularly. So I kind of want to turn to the kind of social context in which these sexual behaviors and sexual relationships were happening. One important thing which I'm going to discuss now is housing. So as I already mentioned, many of the men in our sample, I think just over half, 11 had experienced housing instability in the last 12 months, and 5 are currently homeless. Most men did not bring sexual partners back to their house. A number of men talked about engaging in sexual relationships with and without condoms in order to have a bed for the night. So one guy talked about keeping in touch with an ex-partner who he could be confident would let him stay. And many commented on the fact that unstable housing was not really conducive to having a relationship. I think the full quote is on the slide. But even among those who did have stable housing, which was just under half, most of these guys didn't live alone. Many of them lived with friends and with family members. And for a lot of them, they talked about privacy being an issue. So many of these guys avoided bringing people back home. A lot of them wished to keep aspects of either their sexual lives or sexual identity secret. And there are a number of them lived with family members who didn't approve of homosexuality. So one participant was 24 years old, out, self-identified as gay, but he lived with his mother. And his mother said he could not have sex at home because it was un-American. Another guy, so he did have his own apartment, and he was in a long-term relationship with his boyfriend, but he too avoided having sex in his own apartment, and this is because his landlord had made homophobic comments. He'd made it very clear his boyfriend wasn't welcome on the premises. He also worried about his neighbors overhearing him and was just very uncomfortable there. Mentioned at the time that he was looking for a new apartment somewhere where it would like explicitly say it was gay-friendly. And his reasoning for moving places, I'll just read a quote. So he said, regardless of how they feel about me having sex there, at least I would feel safe about the idea of bringing my partner over. So I think together these kind of stigma, lack of privacy, housing instability, they kind of tell us a lot about this dimensions shaping this kind of patterns. So I'm just going to turn to the next kind of spaces. Most of the men had used apps, as I said earlier. Many saw this as a kind of safe option, talked about it in terms of being a kind of much more easy to arrange details that might be difficult to do in person. So these are things like whether someone had a girlfriend, whether or not the person was out, whether they had their own place, whether the other party wanted to use a condom. We also heard about people like specifying things like, drug and disease-free partners. And so those seem to be like a negotiation of social and health risk happening in this context. Apps were also used as a means for facilitating sex work, and several of the men who engaged in sex work could use the internet to make these kind of exchanges. Men also reported meeting other men and having sexual relationships with other men in parks, streets, gyms, trains, and restaurants. This was often arranged in advance using things like Jack and Grindr or sometimes in public spaces themselves. So we looked at some kind of known or not known cruising spots across various New York parks. And we found that although the park is a very public space in some ways, cruising often happens in the daytime, most of the men who went to these spots talked about them in terms of being secret or discreet, and sometimes saw these as kind of socially safer than being physically out and about with a male partner. A number of bisexual men who had female partners sought sex in these spaces to avoid jeopardizing relationships, and several of the men who identified as heterosexual hung out in cruising spots such as parks rather than in gay nightclubs or bars. And found that this enabled them to preserve a public heterosexual identity. Although we did find evidence of condom use in these sites, it was found to be generally inconsistent, and many of the men mentioned that interactions in these places are often rushed, and that wasn't always a conversation that happened. The discretion, which seems to attract men to this place in the first place, doesn't really seem to be a reflection of total anonymity. Although to a novice, they seem to offer a kind of opportunity to hook up anonymously. Most men knew of and could identify other regular cruisers. And so one informant talked about how using his cell phone, he could identify other men who were out and about, and also reduce the chances of coming in into contact with someone who was dangerous, homophobic, or an undercover cop. So a number of the guys had mentioned the police and also the risk of being physically assaulted in these kind of spaces. I'm just going to talk a little bit about sex work or kind of exchanging sex for desired or necessary goods. I know I've touched upon it already, but I think it's a key component of this relationship between economic hardship in this broader economic context and sexual behavior. So many men saw their sexual relationships as a means to satisfy certain needs. This included necessary goods such as housing and food, and also desirable goods such as clothes and also drugs or alcohol. So one 24-year-old gay man who generated his income primarily from sex with and without condoms, and he described this as a means of putting food on the table. In contrast, another guy, he recounted having sex in order for favors such as having a phone bill paid. And one worrying finding was that a number of men who were sex workers mentioned avoiding carrying condoms when working. And this, they said, was because the police could use condom possession as a form of evidence of sex work. And I think it's worth noting that in New York, it was only in June 2013 that the Assembly passed the No Condoms as Evidence bill, which would stop police and prosecutors from using condom possession as evidence of sex work. And I think this really speaks to how mistrust of NYPD as an institution that targets young black men, along with a continued fear of being profiled, has created lasting problems for HIV prevention efforts, particularly those that distribute condoms. Okay, so in terms of conclusions and implications for public health, I think more broadly, these findings call attention to the need to address economic and social factors such as housing and employment and policing practices. And also addressing stigma in our HIV prevention efforts. I think more specifically, the take-home message is that for this sample of men, the issues of housing insecurity, economic hardship, lack of privacy, and stigma shaped their choices, their relationships, and their behaviors. And I'll end here with a quote, which I hope you can read. And I think it highlights how together these kind of economic and social factors shape perceptions of risk and shape what kinds of things seem risky, what kind of things seem dangerous, which risks are worth taking, and which are simply unavoidable. It's going to come to kind of, a limitation of this. This is a small group of men. This is not representative of all black MSM in New York City and may not be representative of all black MSM of lower socioeconomic status. Just finish with acknowledgements. This was a team effort. The PI was Jennifer Hirsch. The lead ethnographer was Jonathan Garcia. And Jonathan and I were the coders of the data. And as I said, this was part of a bigger parent study, which was funded by NIMH and was looking at healthcare engagement and sexual relationships among black MSM. I think the official title's just there. But don't do any questions because there's two more presentations. Ignore that.